Well, you got your New York accent.
Really?
New York.
I'm always so surprised when I hear myself on radio, because in my mind, I may not sound like an Episcopalian, but, you know, I don't sound the way. And then, oh, listen to her. She sounds like she's from Brooklyn, which indeed
what
is the truth.
What do Episcopalians sound like?
Not like me.
Because you were born in Brooklyn.
Yes, I was.
So you have what was formerly called a Brooklyn accent.
That's right.
I don't think they talk like that in Brooklyn anymore, do they? They've all moved out to Long Island.
That's right. And so now we've just, we're sort of easternly mobile. And we've taken the accent with us, at least our generation. My kids don't speak like this.
Well, it's hard to believe that once I had a Texas accent, and that was beaten out of me in the sixth grade when I moved to Ohio.
Oh, really? I lived in Ohio for
where
a while.
About?
Cincinnati.
Unfortunately, I lived in Toledo. But much rather live in Cincinnati, until recently, of course, when I heard about all the pornography problems.
That's right. But listen, the case, the jury did fine. So that was very nice. Justice sometimes triumphs.
I had been to Cincinnati a couple of times during my college years, which were also in Ohio, and I thought it was a very charming city.
It is. It's a pretty city. Culturally, it's way up there. It's very, very conservative. And I lived there in the late 50s, which was, you know, just the full flowering of Eisenhower Republicanism. And it just didn't really suit me, mainly because I couldn't get my hair to become a blonde page boy.
And what were you doing in Cincinnati?
My dad moved around a lot. He was an engineer.
You know, they make something very unique in Cincinnati that you don't find anyplace else. It's called Cincinnati chili.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's wonderful.
Yeah,
it's wonderful. It can put you away for a couple of days. But
that's
it's really
true.
Great.
But you can't get it around here.
No, I know.
You have to make it yourself.
That's right.
But the recipe calls for things like cinnamon.
Really?
Yeah, it has cinnamon in it and nutmeg. Yeah.
Because you don't taste it in there. It's just...
Yeah, you don't. But you don't use cumin. You don't use those.
Right.
It's different. It's very hot, though, and you put it on
noodles.
Spaghetti.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And put cheese and raw onions on top.
That's
it's
right.
Really, for Texans like myself, of course, it's not pure chili.
Oh, of course not.
But it's not bad.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself, and we'll work up to magic hour. You were born in Brooklyn. Did you ever, as a child, envision yourself being a writer?
No, I never did. I was not one of these cute little 8-year-olds who kept a journal, you know, and had a sensitive soul.
I bet your mother gave you a diary, though, a little diary that had
a diary,
lock on it.
Yeah, a diary with a little lock on it, and I probably lost the key and got bored with it by January 6th. You know, I never thought of that because people like me didn't become novelists. People like me just didn't have career ambitions.
What do you mean, people like you?
People, girls, 50s, lower middle class. You know, I mean, what you aspire to is to meet a nice guy, a doctor or a lawyer, or preferably, and if not, then a pharmacist or an accountant. You know, they're echelons, and become a wife and mother. And the injustice of it never enraged me. I mean, I just said, well, this is what my life is going to be like, and I certainly hope I meet a nice guy.
I don't know that you should characterize it as an injustice. It was just the way things were.
That's
for that
right.
Period.
That's
for,
right.
For you in that, but, in that
yeah,
period.
Exactly. Exactly.
But you did aspire. I mean, you went to college.
Yeah, I went to college because that's where you meet eligible guys. But I went to Queens. If I had gotten into Radcliffe, oh, my mother would have been so happy. But instead, I went to Queens. And then afterwards, not having been pinned, engaged, and married, I had to get a job. So I went to 17 Magazine and started writing advice to the lovelorn under the house name of Abigail Wood. And
what were some of the questions and answers you might have had, some samples?
Oh, it was some, Dear 17, how do you know if you're pregnant? And
how do you know?
Well, we answered as best we could. We also had a psychiatrist on call if, you know, there are any really sad stories.
But I would imagine most of your answers were simply common sense.
Most of them were absolutely common
sense. I'm sure you
didn't
make up the questions, so that's what I hear, dear Abby.
Oh, no, because there are so many kids out there with nobody to give them answers to. I mean, in some of, you know, how do you talk to a boy? It's either a very basic common sense answer or such a cosmic question that it can't be answered at all. So we chose the first and, you know, made a few suggestions, and it was all very nice. And then eventually I sort of rose in the ranks, mainly because the pay was so abysmal, everybody else kept quitting. And I just stayed on.
You mean 17 hired you just to do that advice to the lovely?
Well, no, it was answer all reader mail. You know,
you were like a jack of all trades.
A jack of all trades, and then gradually I rose through the ranks.
What does that mean? You wrote it.
I write it.
Started writing articles.
I started writing articles, and teen bands. How to write a letter to a boy. I did the book review again. I stay the jack of all trades. I did the book review column for them. Did all teen written features. Very often rewrote whatever the kids wrote. So, you know, it was at least somewhat comprehensible. And I kept rising in the ranks, and I eventually became a senior editor. But that happened just about the time I became pregnant with my first kid, and I quit to stay home with kid.
It was a terrific experience for you, though, wasn't it?
It was a wonderful experience. First of all, about a year into it, I was filling out a passport application. It said occupation, and I wrote down writer. And then I looked at it, and I said, oh, I'm a writer. And I was delighted. I thought, hey, this is a good thing to be. And it was also a wonderfully congenial atmosphere with a lot of good people, a lot of good writers, women, other women, people to have lunch with and gossip with, and I had a very good time there.
I hear that some writers who apply for visas and passports and have to put down their application, instead of putting down writer, they put down waiter. If they go to a third world country, it's supposed to be safer that way.
Yeah, well, those were more innocent and untroubled times.
But so. Didn't I read in some of the publicity material that you also did some political work?
Sure. That was after after I quit 17, I did some freelance political speech writing.
Anybody I know?
Well, I I started at
Abby Stevenson, perhaps?
Donald Manus,
uh-huh.
The borough, late borough president of Queens, and also did some writing for in the campaigns for Herman Badillo and Robert Morgenthau when he ran for governor. But mainly, and I did those as a volunteer, once I started writing, it was for local Queens and Brooklyn Democrats who occasionally wanted to sound as if they were giving a highly literate speech, although did they get the wrong girl, but couldn't afford their own speechwriter. And it was a lot of fun.
Gee, I'd hate that. I was going to say it's
so opposite to
fiction, but then on second thought, perhaps speech writing for Manners and other politicians wasn't so far from
fiction.
Well,
it's not, because I'll tell you, well, that's true. But also because it teaches you to listen to the sound of the voices. And if you're writing for a Brooklyn councilman, you can't give him Kennedy-esque phrases and rhetoric. You have to listen to how a person talks and write the way they speak. And it really helped me with my ear for dialogue. I mean, I didn't know I was in training for anything at that time. I just thought I was doing a few speeches. I did some freelance articles on non-phosphate detergents. I wrote some fashion copy just to keep my, because I liked that word on the line. I liked that word writer. And so even though I was, you know, really deep into Pampers and Enfamil, I wanted to stay a writer.
But you did fulfill your goal. I mean, you wanted to be a housewife, marry a lawyer, and live
That's
on
right.
Long Island.
I did. I did all those 50 things that I was trained to. And the nice part of it is that it turned out wonderfully well. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, doing the right thing. It was that indeed it really was right for me. So all that was fine, but I still wanted something more. And what I wanted, it occurred to me after my second kid was born, was that I wanted to write a novel. And I went through a real thrash. Who am I to write a novel? I'm not Joyce Carol Oates. I'm not Virginia Woolf. I'm not haunted. But by the same token, I'm not a Jacqueline Suzanne Glamorpus. And what could I possibly write that would be of interest to anyone? So it took me over a year to really get up my courage. And I did everything in the world I could to avoid writing. I mean, I did exquisite laundries. I folded socks in the most incredible way. Did loads and loads. I was volunteer of the year. I did everything except write because it was so overwhelming. But finally, I think the need to write, the need to tell a story was so strong that finally I just exhausted myself.
I was talking to novelist Terry Crews a couple of months ago.
Right.
He was telling me, he gave me a wonderful story, which is along the lines you just told me. You said, who were you to think about writing a novel? I mean, you? Well, Terry Crews is a man who was born in a sharecropper family.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have running water until, well, he never had running water until he joined the Marines, and,
mm-hmm.
and he saw that at Marine camp they actually had running water in the barracks. They didn't even have a tractor. They had mules who pulled the plow. He is also, would like to be an athlete, but he has hurt his legs riding motorcycles, and but he goes to the gym every day. And he said, when I go to the gym, I take to the gym what I have to take to the gym. And he says which isn't much, but he goes and he works out every day anyway. And when he writes a novel, he takes to the novel what he has to take to the novel. And he would say the same thing you might say. Who am I? I'm not a Hemingway, but I'm Harry Cruz, and what I have, I put into my work.
Absolutely. I mean, right from the beginning, I don't know how I knew, but I knew that I had to listen to the sound of my own voice. But all I had was Susan Isaacs. I wasn't Jane Austen, and I wasn't Judith Krantz, or I wasn't anybody else except me. But why be a second or third or fourth rate Jane Austen? What's the point of trying to imitate somebody else? So when I sat down to write, I chose the mystery form, partly because I loved it, and partly because it didn't seem as audacious as saying, I'm writing a novel. At least if I was going to be anything, I could sort of follow in the tracks and be a sort of Semitic Agatha Christie. But I decided to write about what I knew, which was being a Long Island housewife.
And a wonderful novel it was, too. Compromising Positions was such a successful book. Did it even surprise you?
It more than surprised me. It stunned me. I mean, when they actually gave me an advance, they gave me a $5,000 advance. I mean, I would have paid them if I'd had the money. But I was flabbergasted. And the success of it, they're just... Nothing can prepare you for it. So you sort of expect, you know, it was a Book of the Month Club main selection, and it was the movies bought it, and, you know, suddenly I said, someone's paying for the Icelandic rights? I mean, I couldn't believe all of this. On the other hand, once you get the news, or your agent or your editor calls you up with all this good news, you're still at home on Long Island with two kids, a husband, a couple of dogs, and a typewriter. So what do you do? I mean, you know, I could put on a feather boa and come into Manhattan and, you know, try to...
What do you do? You sit down
You
and
sit
write
down? Absolutely. That's exactly it. So I wrote another one.
That's in your genes now.
That's it. I think it probably was. I think that's right. I think that you're probably either born with it or, if not, develop it by the time you're 7 years old, 8 years old. But whatever it is, whatever that talent, that storytelling talent is, that ability to fashion another universe and kind of be a god, even though it's certainly a fifth-rate god, you don't know it until you're right. You don't know whether you have it. I think a lot of people feel that they have a novel within them. I know I did, but there was no way of knowing until I actually sat down and wrote the thing.
And yet you kind of wanted to get away from housewife detectives in the suburbs.
Sure, because what can happen then is that, especially once you've gotten successful, that it can become a formula. And I would be writing Judith Singer Goes Hawaiian. And I didn't want to do that. I sensed that there was more to me and more in me than just writing that one character. I mean, I took on the suburbs. I finished with the suburbs, and I was ready to do something else.
Of course, in your new book, you're back in the suburbs.
Well, I'm back. No, I'm not. I'm back on Long Island.
Well, I guess it's a little far from the suburbs, actually. The Hamptons,
right.
Doesn't really quite qualify.
But that's also writing about what I know, because over the years, I mean, I'm no longer carving up peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I've gone on and have written, you know, this is my fifth novel. I've written two movies. I'm writing a third. I've been out in the Hamptons, so I know the Hamptons. I know the territory. And in the first page, I kill off an executive producer. But that's because I've made a couple of movies. I know who deserves to die. So I know. So I use that as background, and it's. But then I go. My foreground is my mystery. Then this is the first time I've used a man.
What I liked about compromising positions, and also a Magic Hour to a degree, although the characters are certainly different. That relatively naive and innocent people somehow find themselves in the middle of a crisis or a crime. Mm-hmm. Hitchcock did this magnificently in his films. And I've always liked that. Because here you have vulnerable people who somehow find their way and solve a crime or come out of a crisis. I like that better than the heroic type of characters such as, but even James Bond. Everybody likes James Bond. But
right.
A Mel Gibson type, you know. I mean, nobody's a Mel Gibson type, or the Rambo types. You know, they're not believable because people are vulnerable and they mm-hmm. get colds and they get ill and they get weak and they get scared. All male and females.
That's
There's
right.
not very many really heroic figures. So I like the delicacy of someone who finds himself in a compromising position and comes out of it. And to a degree, the detective in Magic Hour is like that too, because he comes out of the 60s a drug addict and alcoholic, and while he is a police officer, he doesn't strike me as the toughest guy in the world.
No, he's not. He's not the toughest guy in the world. He's a very good cop and a smart cop. But he's barely holding his life together. I mean, he's cured his drug addiction early on, pretty soon after Vietnam. But then he becomes an alcoholic. He's recovering, though. He's going to AA. He's met a nice young woman, and at age 40, he's engaged. She's lovely. She's decent, and everything seems to be fine, except he's holding on by a thread, and he's not happy. And what I wanted to write about was the possibility of redemption for an ordinary, middle-aged, battered guy.
And his crisis is not so much the murder he is investigating, but the fact that he falls for the prime suspect in the murder.
That's right. That's right. And all of a sudden, this kind of sad guy finds herself having a marvelous time with this woman who's totally inappropriate. I mean, she's the wrong age. She's 5 years older than he is. She's the wrong religion. She's has a kind of a wise guy mouth. I mean, she's all wrong, except he finds her absolutely delightful, and he's starting to come alive through her. Except she very well might be the thing that he hates most, and that's a killer.
Yeah, men do have a tendency, and women too, have a tendency often to fall for the most inappropriate types. Although I think it should be stated, or maybe I shouldn't state it because I don't want to spoil the ending, that she is not necessarily inappropriate for him.
Not necessarily. I'll go that far.
The title, Magic Hour, actually has two meanings.
Yeah, it's a term in cinematography. It's the hour, short period of time, after dawn or right before dusk, where you can still shoot without lighting, where the light itself, the natural light, is beautiful, and you can get some wonderful, almost magical effects. It also is, for Steve Brady, our homicide cop, it's those couple of moments in his life that allow for the possibility of grace and of something better than he is. But if you miss that short period of time, then you lose it.
I think you can also apply it to some erotic feelings as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's some moments with Bonnie, who's the suspect, the ex-wife of the producer and a failed screenwriter. There are some wonderful moments with Bonnie, and afterwards he looks up and he says, "I love this time of day." And she says, "Oh, this is magic hour." And she's talking about it, of course, in terms of the movies, but of course to Steve it means something quite different.
Now, Susan, you've written, in addition to your five novels, you've written two screenplays. Mm-hmm. I think you said you're working on a third one.
Right, because I'm a masochist.
What? Tell me about the inherent differences between writing fiction, novels, and screenwriting.
In writing novels, you're in complete control.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, as much control as you have. I mean,
under personal control.
Under personal control. That's right. Not under. Forget artistic control.
Right.
Who of us has that kind of control? But you furnish your characters with histories, with thoughts, with moral sense. You wallpaper their rooms. You choose their cars. I mean, Steve, when Steve came to me, I knew he would be driving a 63 XKE, and I knew he'd be an avid Yankee fan. Why, I don't know, but this whole, you construct this whole world. In film, writing a movie, you're writing really what is the blueprint. You're writing the story, you're writing the dialogue, but then you're going to have set decorators, costume designers, directors, actors, cinematographers. It's a collaborative effort. And there's this auteur theory of filmmaking it's really the director's. It can't be. It has to be a collaboration. And that's part of the fun of it for me as a novelist. And that's why I really got into it, was because of the collaboration. Because, frankly, after sitting around for 3 years in front of a word processor, it's a chance to have lunch.
But don't you ever feel that your story has been taken away from you to a degree?
Sure it is. Absolutely. And that's why it's so frustrating to some of us. In compromising positions, I wrote the screenplay. So to that extent, it was under my control. But then the director, Frank Perry, had very strong ideas of his own. The star, Susan Sarandon, had her own ideas. And then every actor who signs on has a certain vision, and the cinematographer, Barry Sonnenfeld. Everybody has a vision, and you all work together. And at times, can it be frustrating? I mean, you truly want to chew the walls sometimes. Of course, it's so maddening.
Isn't there a point that the writer becomes obsolete on in a screenplay, that you give them your screenplay and then you might as well go back to Long Island?
Yes and no. It depends on the director, really, or who's ever in charge. In this case, the director was someone who had worked with writers before, was comfortable, and recognized that if a character is going across a room and the room, the angle that they've chosen needs a few extra lines, better that the writer should create them than have the actors improvise them. Or, yeah, I mean, you know, you have a long walk, you can't hum. It's a movie. So, in that case, in my fourth book, Shining Hour, which is being made into Shining Through Shining Hour. I'm getting Magic Hour, whatever it's called. It's now being made into a movie with Melanie Griffith and Michael Douglas and John Gielgud. I have absolutely nothing to do with that. And do I feel powerless? Sure.
But you wrote the original screenplay for it.
No, I did not. No, they hired a writer-director, David Seltzer. Mm. And so they've assembled...
Do you feel left out?
No, because I chose to be left out. You know, you can, quote, attach yourself to a project and say, you're not going to make my movie unless you take me. You can't do that all the time and still stay a good novelist or try to be a good novelist, because you won't have the time. It takes 2 or 3 years to write a novel. It takes 6 months to a year to write a screenplay, and then another... whatever it is to actually make the movie. I'm not a mogul with a big cigar. I can't order people around and do my bidding. I mean, writing essentially is sitting in a corner and sucking your thumb and telling yourself a story. And you can't delegate that to everybody. So I can't do every single project.
Well, Susan Isaacs, I know your growing legion of fans will... enjoy Magic Hour and the fact that you've gotten back to a detective story. Just one last question. Now that you have 5 novels behind you and 2 screenplays and working on a third, what has all this done to you and your family and your neighbors? And I guess you must be a neighborhood celebrity now.
Well, you know, when I'm walking with a shopping cart through Walbaum's, people don't go, ugh. I mean, I'm part of the community. I'm active in it, and everybody kind of knows me. Every once in a while, you'll see someone poke somebody else, but you never know whether they're poking because they're saying, there is Susan Isaacs, living American novelist, or whether they're saying, can you believe that sweatsuit she's wearing? So I never know. So I just go about my business, and it's very comfortable. Still have the same... still live in the same town, still have the same husband, same kids, same dog, new car.
And new books.
And new books, yeah.
Susan Isaacs, thank you very much.
Thank you.